Record. Okay. It looks happy. Okay. So if you're coming in, please grab one copy of each handout at the front. There are extra ones or should be sitting at the seats, but just in case, to make sure that you get one. This is CDS 101 and CDS 110A. For those of you who haven't met me, I'm Richard Murray. So what I want to do in lecture today is start by just giving you an overview of this class, talk about what it's about, the various, course structure, exams, all of that stuff. I also want to then start a little bit into the material. So in particular, I'll define feedback systems and talk about some of the main features of feedback systems. I will also talk about control systems and the differences between feedback systems and control systems. You got one. Everybody got one? Some of the main principles of feedback. Okay? All right, so let's just start by going through the syllabus. Let's see if I've still got a copy of one. No? Where is there an extra copy of a syllabus lying around? Probably right there, right? Is there one under there?
No.
There's one. Okay, good. Okay, very first thing is that this is actually two classes sitting on top of each other. So some of you are here for CDS 110A and some of you are here for CDS 101. You can take either class. You can, up to a point, switch between these classes. What's the difference between them? CDS 110A is a 9-unit class. It focuses on the engineering tools for analyzing and designing feedback systems. It goes into what you need to know to, in the first term, analyze a system, and in CDS 110B, design a control system. We'll do a little bit of design toward the end, but mainly analysis work. CDS 101 is focused more on the principles and tools as opposed to the engineering analysis. That is, we'll talk about what feedback systems are and some of the tools that exist, things like tools in MATLAB, to analyze those systems. But we won't go into as much depth into some of the analytical details about how control systems work and how feedback systems work. There's still some seats up here. This room's going to be completely full, so you better get a seat now. It's a 6-unit course, CDS 101. And the way that it works is if you're in CDS 101, then you have lectures on Mondays and Fridays. If you're in CDS 110, you have lectures on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And when the homeworks come out, you'll see that essentially the first couple of problems are for people in CDS 101 and CDS 110, and the next set of problems are for people just in CDS 110. So CDS 110, same material, same Monday lecture. CDS 110 is going to have more work, and you're going to get more units of credit. All right? And it's going to go into some of the analytical details. We'll derive things. We'll prove things out. We'll kind of dive in a little bit more. All right? So that's sort of the difference between the two classes. The way that lectures will work is that we'll have lectures like this in this room on Mondays and Wednesdays, and Friday will be a recitation section. The first couple of Fridays, we're going to have tutorials on MATLAB and Simulink, but starting in the third week, we'll have a recitation section, and in that recitation section, you'll break up into smaller groups with a TA and go over material that's relevant for the course. And so we'll break down into those. We'll have office hours. Well, actually, let me skip a little bit because it's probably better to talk about it in the context of the homework. There will be a homework set that comes out every Monday starting today, and it will be posted on the web page. And the URL for the web page is listed here, and I will send email out tonight with that URL to everybody who is on the class list. And it will come out at 8 o'clock, no later than 8 o'clock tonight, so you can grab the first homework set. Homeworks always come out on Mondays. They are due the following Monday at 5 p.m. Everybody in the class gets a grace period of 2 days to turn them in. So they're due on Monday at 5 p.m., and I'm going to start lecturing on the next topic on that Monday. All right? So the idea is there's a topic a week. You hand out the homework set. You see the lectures. By Wednesday, you'll have all of the material you need. On Friday, there'll be a recitation about the topic. On the next Monday, that homework set is due. All right? If you aren't done with it or you got behind or whatever, you don't need to ask for an extension. You automatically have an additional 2 days to turn it in. It won't count against you, nothing bad, but I'm going to have started on the next topic. All right? And so if you want to stay up with the class and kind of keep with things, my advice is to turn the homeworks in on Monday. I know that it's busy and you've got all different classes. This class has a lot of different people with a lot of different backgrounds, and it's impossible not to hit on top of at least one large class's due date. And so I just provide a little bit of buffer in there to do that. Okay, so The cycle is Mondays to Mondays, so we'll have office hours, and we'll post these on the web, but the current plan is to have office hours on Fridays in the afternoons after the recitation. If you're in the recitation, you still had some detailed questions, et cetera, and then on Sundays. All right. And so on Sundays, if you're working on the homework for the next day, we'll have a recitation on Sunday afternoon. If you don't like to work on weekends or you have other plans, make sure to come to the office hours on Fridays. All right. Okay, so... grading for the class is, one other thing about office hours. Office hours are, you are required to show up for office hours at least once in the first 3 weeks. You don't have to do anything more than show up and say, hi, I'm here, and sign the list that says you showed up. You don't have to ask a question, but you need to at least show up. And that's mainly so that you know what the TAs actually look like, and you know they're not really scary, and you know, we know where you got to go, and all of that stuff. But we keep track of it, and if you haven't done that, then some unimaginably horrible thing happens when it comes around to grading that I haven't decided yet, because so far everybody's always just heeded my advice and gone. All right, so make my life easy. Please go, and I'll remind you about this. Grading is based on homework, midterm, and final. So the homework will count 50% for your grade. There'll be a homework set every week, except midterms week and the last week of class, in which I'll hand out the midterm and final instead. But basically, there's a homework set every week, 8 homeworks total. Those 8 homeworks will typically be about 40 points each. 40 to 50 points each, depending on the problems, and that will count for half of your grade. The midterm will count for 20% of your grade. The final will count for the remaining 30% of your grade. Homeworks are collaborative. You are encouraged to collaborate and work with people and figure out how to do them, but what you turn is your homework needs to reflect your understanding of that problem. And so in particular, you should work with people and figure everything out and then go and write up your homework set. Right, here's how this problem works out. The midterm and final are not collaborative. They're obviously individual. They are typically, I won't make any guarantees, I change a little bit every year, but they're typically 3-hour open book take-home exams handed out usually on the first day of midterms or finals and due on the last day of midterms or finals. So you can, if you're scheduling when you're going to take your finals and go home or other things, you should have it the first day of finals week, and it will be due the last day of finals week. Okay. But on the homework... because you're getting an automatic 2-day grace period, there is no late homework unless I get a note from the medical center or the deans saying that for some reason or another you're not able to turn in your homework in time. Okay, so you don't need to send me an email asking if you can turn in late homework. You can simply show up with your signed excuse saying, here's why I couldn't turn in the homework on the after the 2-day grace period. Okay, so no late homeworks. I think that's that for that. For the homework sets, in terms of the homework policy for collaboration, you can collaborate with each other all you want. You can collaborate with students who took the class in the past and ask them. You can obviously collaborate with, meaning ask questions of the TAs. What you cannot do is use the written solutions from previous years, because I sometimes reuse some of the problems. And so if students have the written solutions, and we will post solutions on the webpage after everybody's turned in the homework and when we hand it back. And so if somebody's printed out those solutions, then you're not allowed to use those written solutions. But you can certainly ask somebody from the class, do you remember how to do this, that, or the other? Or how do you get the Nyquist plot when you have a right half plane zero or whatever it is? Okay. All right. I already talked about has to reflect your thing. Oh, for homeworks and for the midterm and final, but really for homeworks, this mainly matters. MATLAB scripts and plots are considered to be part of the work you do on your own. And so in particular, you're not allowed to simply work in a big group and put together a MATLAB script and you all turn in that MATLAB script or generate a bunch of plots and you all turn in those plots. What I want you to learn in the class is how to use those tools. And so part of the individual work, you can talk with people, you can sit and work interactively on MATLAB until you get it, but the MATLAB script that you turn in on problems that require MATLAB and the plots that you turn in need to be your own work. You need to have written that script, you need to have generated those plots so that we get to make sure that you really do know how to use those tools. We'll use MATLAB and Simulink a lot. Caltech has site licenses for those. We'll talk more about both of those tools in the Friday lecture slot. The course text is this book here, which is available in the bookstore. Costs $36. It is a book that is in the version that's here is probably about 90% final form. The only thing that's not final in this is some of the figures are getting revised a little bit. You'll see a couple of hand-drawn things. It will come out in March or April of 2008 as a textbook from Princeton University Press. So this is a preprint of that exact textbook as it's going to come out. And so that's what we'll use as the text for the course. Okay, and then the last thing I'll go over at the end, which is just the course outline that's here, and so I'll talk about that at the end of the lecture. Okay, in terms of things above the line, which are all things on the syllabus, any questions on any of that?
Can I use last year's?
Sorry?
Can I use last year's?
There are differences. So if you try and use last year's book, you'll find that the problem numbers may be different. The material is more or less the same. You're welcome to give it a shot. There are tons of corrections. And so if you come in and get the wrong answer because you used last year's version that had a bug, well, that's you get graded on what you used. So, other questions? Okay, a couple of other administrative things. So in lecture, I will not hand out a single piece of paper for this course, homeworks or anything else, with one exception, which is whenever I give a lecture that is PowerPoint up on the board, you will always get a copy of the slides ahead of time, so you don't have to try and keep up with me as I start going through things, all right, and pictures and other stuff. But other than that, there are no handouts that come out, and so you will need to use the web to get copies of the homework problems. You'll need to use the web to get copies of the solutions as they come out. We will post lots of information on the web. If there's a problem on one of the homework sets or other things, we'll use mailing lists to send email out to the entire class. So all of those things. So to make sure all of that works, and in particular to make sure that I have a mailing list that's complete, I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet. I give one to every other row. If you're at the end of the row, please pass it back one row. And what I need you to do is just put down your name and your year and the option and whether you pre-registered or not. This information helps me make sure that I don't duplicate your name. If there are two people with similar names or other things, I can make sure that I know off of the information I get from the registrar. And then most importantly, your email address legibly, all right, because somebody manually has to go type this in. And I will send out an email probably tonight saying homework one is posted on the web, and it'll come out, and if you don't get that email sometime tonight, then somehow you didn't get added to the mailing list, and if you're listening to this on the MP3 recording, then make sure that you're on the mailing list. Okay, so sign up for that, pass that down. And if it's at the end of the row, pass it back a row. There's also, and it's posted on the webpage, a mailing list for the TAs, and so if you have a question, you can certainly email me or one of the TAs directly, but I encourage you to email the TA mailing list. So there's a link to it on the webpage, and the reason to use the TA mailing list is that all of the TAs get it, and so whichever one can respond to that most quickly will respond to it. If you send email to a given TA and they happen to be out of town for 2 days and not checking their email, then you may not get a response back, and if you sent it to them on Tuesday in the middle of your grace period and they don't respond back till Thursday, well, that's not so good. But the TA mailing list, there will always be somebody watching that. Because this is a reasonably big class and because it's got a lot of different people, there will be class conflicts. You might not be able to make it to, you know, one day of the course or a half hour or other things. You might not be here today listening to this. So all of the lectures that I give are recorded, and we put the MP3s up on the webpage after the lecture. And so if you miss a lecture or you're not quite sure what I said or you want to hear it again, you can go back and listen to that lecture. The slides for the lecture when I give lectures are up on the web as well as the printout version. So if you miss a lecture, you didn't get the printouts, you can grab them from the web. When I give a Blackboard lecture, I will not hand out my notes ahead of time, but I will post them to the webpage. And so if you want to come in with the notes that I'm using to give the lecture, you can. I'll try and post them before noon on the day of the lecture, and so you can go look at it sometime before 2 o'clock, print out your own copy and bring it with you if you want, but I'm not going to hand them out because I'll be going at a speed in which you can keep up with me and take your own notes. But if you're somebody who prefers not to take your own handwritten notes and just have the notes, of course, you know, they're the notes that I'm using to guide what I say. They may not be exactly what I say. Okay. When you'll see on the first homework set, one of the things that we ask you to do in this class is to keep track of the number of hours outside of class that you're spending, so the number of hours that you're spending reading and doing the homework sets, and that's because the class differs a little bit every year, and we are trying to tune the amount of work to match the number of units. Those of you who have asked other students about this class probably know that we're not doing such a great job of that yet, and so this class is typically slightly more than 9 units in terms of the average work. And I know exactly how many it is from year to year, homework to homework, because I ask all of you to give me information back so that we can track that. And so I actually do keep track of what the load is over the years and say, okay, let's try and push it down here, let's try and push it up here by adjusting the homework sets and other things. So we need your help in doing that. So I will try and remind you every time a homework set is due to please write the number of hours on the back of the first page of the homework set that you spent on reading and homework. Right, so everything outside of the lecture and recitations and office hours you include too. Just, you know, how much time did you spend in this class minus the lectures? All right, and I will actually report that out so that you can kind of see how the class is doing. Okay, and the last thing on this chart is that in this class I like to have 2 ombuds. The ombuds are students who are members of the class that I meet with, well, as needed, but at least once around midterms time and usually try and do once at the end of the term. And the idea is that there are people that if you don't feel comfortable coming to me or the TAs and saying, you know, Richard talks too fast or his board work sucks or whatever it is, you can go to the ombuds and they will properly anonymize you and say, I don't personally think this, but people in the class have said, okay? And so that's a way to get us feedback. If you don't feel comfortable for any reason, just telling us. And so if you are willing to be an ombudsperson, please send me an email no later than tomorrow evening so that I can get, and I'll want 1 undergraduate and 1 graduate student. So please, if you're willing to be an ombuds and help out the class in that way, you get a free lunch around midterms and finals and meeting with the TAs and me to talk about the class and what we can do to improve it. Okay? Okay, so that's all of the other administrative stuff, and we'll see this come up as it comes up. Questions on any of this? All right, there are a number of people who are involved in teaching this class. And so I just want to put their faces up here. I think they are occupying the back row right now, which is the typical TA position in CDS 110. So me, you know, Julia Brayman, Elisa Franco, Sawyer Fuller, George Hines, Luis Soto are the TAs for the class. And so they come from a variety of different backgrounds. They've all taken this class, so they know what it is. I will give almost all of the lectures, but we will have a guest lecturer for a couple of the lectures when I'm out. And that will be Steve Wado, who is just finished his PhD in CDS and will be an engineer up at JPL starting in mid-December. So he will come talk to us on a couple of topics. All right, so those are the people involved with the class. They're all great people. And so I hope you take the opportunity to quiz them about their knowledge of control systems in answering some of your questions. Okay, and one of the things that we do in this class is we use something called mud cards. And a mud card, so you should each have in front of you a couple of blank cards. Actually, this is a good spot to make sure you have things. If you don't have a copy of the lecture notes, raise your hand. Okay. If you don't have 2 blank 3x5 cards sitting in front of you, raise your hands. Okay, can Julia or somebody, can you make sure they get mud cards? Okay, you need the lecture notes, right? Lecture notes. Who's else's lecture notes? Okay, anybody else with lecture notes? Okay, I'll come over there in a second. Anybody else? Oops, sorry. Okay. Any lecture notes or mud cards? Lecture notes. Lecture notes.
Thank you.
Lecture notes.
Thanks.
Okay, so the deal on mud cards is they start out as a blank 3x5 card. And the idea is that if you have a part of the lecture that you thought was muddy, right, then you should ask me about it. I didn't understand the difference between open loop and closed loop. I didn't understand the difference between stability, performance, and robustness. Whatever it is, if I'm kind of rushing through stuff, you're certainly welcome to, and I encourage you to ask a question in the class. But if you aren't quite sure or you remember halfway through, oh, geez, you know, now he's talking about this and I don't understand what that is, the mud cards are there so that you can write down, right, questions about things that weren't clear to you. I encourage you at the end of today's lecture Just think back and say, well, what parts of this didn't I understand? And ask us a question. What we do with those mud cards is that we take them at the end of the lecture, and so there will be a box in the front and back of the room where you can drop these things off. And what will happen is that one of the TAs will take these and bin them up if there are multiple questions on the same thing, and then distribute them to the other TAs. And by 8 o'clock tonight on the web page, there will be posted, right, your question or some variant of it if multiple people asked it, and a response. Right? And so if there's something you were confused about, come back and look at the web page tonight, right, while you still have the lecture a little bit fresh in your mind, and we will have tried to answer that. All right? And so it's one of the mechanisms that we try to use to make sure that you're understanding the material. We go through quite a lot of material. It goes pretty fast. So if you have questions, please ask either in lecture, using the mud cards if you remember at the end of the lecture. You can send email to the TAs and ask. We'll post those up on the web as well. Okay. And what happens is if you go to the actual web page for the course, then up in the top, there's a thing that says FAQ, and on that FAQ list are the responses to all the mud cards, plus anything else that we get asked, or you know, things that we find a bug in the homework sets, we'll put them there. You will always want to go and look at the FAQ page before you start your homework and see what questions people have asked about the homeworks that we've answered there, so that if there's you know something that's not clear, we've probably clarified it, you'll probably have the same question, and so please make use of that. In addition, there's a wiki for the book, and it's linked up here, and you can go there, and there are copies of the chapters of the book in PDF format. If you're offline, you don't have your book with you, and you want to take a look at it, there are additional exercises there. There are additional frequently asked questions that we've collected over the years that are ones that other students have asked, and so it's intended to be a resource, again, to understand the material. Okay. So now I'm really done talking about the administrative parts of this course and the teaching parts of it. Before I start into the actual material for the course, are there any questions on any of this? Yeah.
Are mud cards required?
They're not required. Don't put your name on them or anything. Just write the question. So you don't need to turn them in. You know, we're not going to keep track of them. They're just a way to give us. You can give us feedback. I couldn't read the charts because the text was too small in the back row. You know, I couldn't read on the board because the lights were wrong. You use them for whatever is useful to you in giving us feedback, right, that for whatever reason you don't ask the question or get it answered in class. But they're not required. Okay. All right, so let me then start through the material in the course. So this course is about feedback systems. And so the very first thing to talk about is, what do we mean by feedback? So if you go look it up in the dictionary, you'll get something like this, a rather old description, but pretty close. So feedback is the return to the input of a part of the output of a machine, system, or process as for producing changes in electronic circuit that improve performance or an automatic control device that provides self-corrective action. All right, so it's kind of hard to parse. Here's a picture of feedback that basically says that. All right, so a feedback system is one in which the output of one system becomes the input of another system, but the output of that second system is in fact the input of the first. And so they're an interconnected set of systems that operate together. And so system one affects system two, but system two affects system one. And so when you're trying to reason about what does this system do, if you just look at system one, then in fact, right, there may be effects in there due to the feedback that you don't recognize. And of course, this is a really classic thing, is that somebody will look at some part of the environment or the financial system or a biological system, and they will say, ah, I understand how this part works, right? Because they're looking at, you know, if I do this, I get this. But what they don't realize, there are huge feedback interactions in there that are affecting what goes on. And so you try and treat some disease and you get a bunch of side effects because there's feedback between all of these parts. And so the idea in feedback systems and in this class is we want to understand how do we kind of unravel what's going on in these interconnected systems. And so I'll use a couple of terms fairly naturally, and so let me define them now. We'll talk about a closed-loop system is one that looks like this. That is, we have system 1 affecting system 2, and then system 2 affecting system 1. When I say open-loop, what we usually mean is that I have a feedback system that for some reason I've broken the feedback interconnection, and so the system is no longer a closed-loop system, but rather an open-loop system in that there is no loop. So open-loop means that I've taken a feedback system and broken the loop. Or I have two systems that are in series with one another, but there's no feedback connection between them. And so we'll talk about open loop dynamics, closed loop dynamics, open loop control, closed loop control, and this is the picture you should think of. So one of the cool things about feedback systems, and one of the things I hope you'll get out of this class, is that they're all over the place, right? Feedback is ubiquitous in both engineering applications, but also in nature. And so as you look around and you try and understand the complicated world that we all live in, I hope that you'll start thinking about, is there feedback in this system and what might that mean? So let me give you a couple of examples of feedback. And so I'll start with one of the ones that's often used in an engineering context, and that's the fly ball governor. So this is one of the earliest successful applications of feedback in industry. And so the fly ball governor is shown here. And the idea on the fly ball governor is, if you have a steam engine, so this dates back to the Industrial Revolution, then one of the challenges in a steam engine is that you've got an engine here, it's producing power, that power is going and getting used for something, maybe a mill or something like that, cutting logs, whatever it happens to be. And a difficulty is that when you apply a load to the system, so for example, suppose it's running a saw and you put some wood to that saw, then you start to apply forces on that blade and it slows down the steam engine. The problem is if you're trying to get very uniform cuts and very nice finishes and other things, you want the speed of the saw to be constant because it's one of the factors there. And so what you'd really like is that when you put that load on there, then the system somehow compensates for that and applies more power. And so a way, and one of the earliest ways to do that, was with this flyball governor. And so here's the idea. You have a belt that's coming in that's attached to some part of the system, and if you look at this diagram here, you see this little flyball governor sitting here, and there's a belt going down to this main wheel on this steam engine that's going to turn. And so the idea is that if the machine speeds up, let's do that one first. If the machine speeds up, then this shaft is going to spin faster. If that shaft spins faster, there's a flyball mechanism above this. It's basically two masses suspended on a little mechanical linkage, and these flyballs are going to want to spin out, right? So they're going to want to spread out because it's spinning faster from the centrifugal forces. So as it spreads out, the linkage then adjusts a valve that controls the amount of steam going to the engine. And so as the engine speeds up and they start to fly out, then we cut down the amount of steam going to the engine, so we slow it down, and then they come back down. Similarly, if the machine slows down, the flyballs start to close down, I can use the mechanism to open up the steam valve and apply more power to the engine. All right? So it's an example of a feedback system because we have the steam engine. We then look at the output of the steam engine, the speed of this shaft here. That goes into the flyball governor. The flyball governor controls the amount of steam going into the engine. Right? And so it modulates that. So it's exactly the type of example of a feedback system that we had in this earlier picture. And as you start looking around, you see lots of these feedback systems around you. Here's what that looks like when it's running. So this is a video that I got off the web. You can tell this person's not a control engineer. They're looking at a steam engine, right? They bypass the most important part of the entire engine, right? Like it's nothing, right? But I mean, that is why a steam engine works. And so in fact, you'll sometimes hear this called the Watt governor. It was not invented by James Watt. The Watt governor was, the flyball governor was not invented by Watt. But what happened was that Watt understood that by putting this on his steam engines and using it and developing a very effective way of selling these things, that he could make a lot more money than other people selling steam engines with governors on them. And so the Watt engine is a steam engine with a flyball governor on it, and Watt made a lot of money off of that and became very famous for it. And so if you ever see a steam engine, look, they all have flyball governors on them, right? And they're often hidden, right, sitting someplace. You don't see them, little tiny thing off to the side. If any of you ever go, there's a really neat flyball governor on the London Bridge in London. Not the London Bridge, the Tower Bridge in London has a couple of big machines at the bottom that open these things up. Beautiful examples of the flyball governor sitting on those. So whenever you see these old machines of this sort, you'll often see these flyball governors. So in engineering, this is an example of feedback that comes up, and it's one of the earliest ones, and it's one that's often used in control text, but there are lots of others. And so in particular, we find in natural systems, in social systems, and other classes of systems, feedback also plays a strong role. So in biological systems, so it's a little bit hot in this room, I'm kind of standing up and gyrating around, my body is reacting to this by sweating a little bit so that I cool down, right? It's trying to maintain my body temperature, so that's an example of homeostasis, trying to maintain at a constant level something, my body temperature at this point, and that's a feedback system. And your body is filled with feedback systems. You're regulating blood sugar level, you're regulating temperature, you're regulating all sorts of things inside of your body. You can also dive down even further. This is an example of a diagram taken out of nature. Which corresponds to the network that's believed to be, or at this time in this paper, responsible for a certain type of cancer in cells. And if you look at this, what you see is there's all sorts of stuff interconnected to all sorts of other things. There are these little arrows going around, right, and everything's interconnected to everything. And this is one of those spots where people will go and they'll focus on this part of the mechanism and they'll say, here's how this works, right? But in fact, they've got the whole cell reacting to this, and so you'll often reason about what's going on here and come up with something that you think is going to change that, but the whole rest of the cell reacts to that in some way that changes, right, your understanding of what's going on here. So it's an example of something where you need to start thinking about the feedback interconnections to understand these systems. Other types of examples of feedback systems in the environmental side, there are things like the global carbon cycle. So this is a drawing sort of showing some of the dynamics of the global carbon cycle. And again, you see feedback interconnections between the amount of vegetation and the way that the atmosphere works and the amount of rain that you get and the surface temperature in the ocean and the thermohaline cycle, right, by which temperature fluxes go around the Earth. All of these are these complicated feedback interconnections. And again, to really understand the dynamics of climate, you need to understand some of those interconnections. At a smaller scale, microbial ecosystems. Your body has its own microbial ecosystem inside, right? It's got a bunch of different types of bacteria that are all interacting with one another, helping you digest food and do everything else. Again, good example of a feedback system. On the financial side, markets are a feedback system, right? Prices go up, people react, that causes the prices to fluctuate more, right? Sometimes they go unstable a little bit, like they have over the last couple of months. Nicely recovering now, thank you very much. Service and supply chains. So as you pick up a part at the store and take it to the cash register, all of a sudden, right, information goes back to some supplier someplace that says, send me another one of these things, which affects the price of those parts, right, and you get this big feedback system going on whether or not you're going to run out of, right, whatever the latest hot product is, right, and all of the interconnections going along with that. So companies like Walmart are famous for having very well tuned their supply chain dynamics, another example of a feedback system now between consumers and producers. So all of these are examples of feedback systems, and in your homework I'll ask you to look around you and find some examples of feedback systems and to identify some of the features that we're going to talk about of those feedback systems. Okay, so feedback is this interconnection between two systems. They can be challenging because one system affects the other, and so you have sort of a loop in terms of trying to reason about that system that you have to sort out. Now, when we talk about control, we mean something a little bit more specific. We mean a type of feedback. And in particular, when we talk about control, what we usually mean is sensing, computation, and actuation coupled together in a feedback loop. So an example of that is if you want to control the velocity of your car. So if you have a car with cruise control on it, this is exactly what's going on. At a high level, this is exactly what's going on. You have your car, and for those of you who've been around a while, probably nobody in this room has been around quite long enough, this is a particular car called Bob, which a bunch of Caltech undergraduates built for the DARPA Grand Challenge in 2004, so a little while ago. And if you want to control the speed of this car as it's racing across the desert, then what you do is you sense the vehicle speed, so you have some sort of a device that measures how fast the wheels are rolling, like the speedometer does on your car. You then take that sensed speed, you compare it to the speed you'd like to be going, and you compute how much I'd like to press the gas pedal. And so the gas pedal is what is going to be the input to this system. I can control the amount of gas going to the engine. As I apply more gas, I'll speed up. As I speed up, then I may back off on the gas to hold a constant speed. And so we talk about the sensing being to sense the variables or parts of the system that you'd like to regulate. The computation then compares those sensed variables to their desired values and outputs something to an actuator that changes the dynamics of the system such that you track the desired outputs. And so I'll often talk about a control law, and what I mean by a control law is really the thing that connects the sensors to the actuators. It's the rule that says if I'm going slow by 5 miles per hour from my desired speed, how much should I press the gas pedal? If I'm starting to catch up to that, when should I start to back off? That's all the control law or control algorithm that we talk about in a control system. So if you're designing, so control systems we usually think of as being something that is designed, although we can also find them in nature. So in biology, you find lots of these control systems. But when we're designing a control system, we have a couple of goals. One is that we'd like the system to be stable. That is, and we're going to talk about all of these concepts in much more detail as we go through the course. But roughly, stability means that in this context of this example, that we hold the desired operating point. Right? So we've probably all had the misfortune of driving with somebody who's not very good at this, right? And so they kind of go, right? And so you're sitting there getting sick, right? Because they can't maintain a constant speed, right? They're just oscillating around this speed. And so you'd like that not to happen. So we say that a system is stable if it maintains a desired operating point, for example, holding a steady speed. We can also talk about the performance of the system. The performance is really how rapidly we respond to changes. So, for example, if the room all of a sudden gets hotter, how rapidly does my body, is my body able to react to that and cool me down, right? And that, you know, involves all of the dynamics of my system and how quickly I sense that it's getting hotter and how quickly I can sweat and all of those types of things. In the context of a cruise control system, if I suddenly say I'd like to be going 10 miles per hour faster, how quickly do I get that 10 miles per hour faster? Does that happen within 3 or 4 seconds? And so I very quickly, right, in my Porsche, vroom, right, I'm really going, right? Or does that take a half hour, right, to catch up, right, and get that speed? So that's the performance of the system. A system can be stable and have crummy performance. Right? It's very hard for a system to be unstable and have good performance, right? Those two don't go together. But just because a system's stable doesn't mean that it has good performance. And finally, we can talk about wanting the system to be robust, and we're going to define that fairly precisely toward the end of this quarter. But roughly speaking, we mean that it tolerates perturbations in the dynamics. So for example, on one day I may have a full tank of gas, on another day I may have an empty tank of gas, I might be driving on sand, I might be driving on hard roads. I would like that my control system performs well, has stability and good performance, no matter which of those conditions happen to be true. And so I'd like that it not depend on the details. If this is a passenger car, I might have 2 people in it, 4 people in it, 8 people in it, and so I'd, again, like that that not matter. Okay, so just to kind of show you what a control system looks like in action, I like this because it's sort of a really interesting looking vehicle with lots of junk on it. But this is a control system running back in March of 2004. This was all designed by Caltech undergraduates. This is a completely autonomous vehicle. It has sensors on it, feedback loops to figure out what's going on, but it's also maintaining its speed. And so it's regulating, it's measuring how fast am I going down the road, what's the speed limit in this region, and then adjusting that. And the vehicle behind here can tell us to stop, that's about it, in case something goes wrong. But the system is regulating its performance, sensing not only its speed, but its speed, its lateral position, the location of obstacles, and using all of that to try and decide what to do. So when we designed Bob, we essentially applied the principles of this class at some of the lower levels of what was going on, and then applied some of the things that come beyond this class, and in particular some of the things we'll talk about in 110B. And you can see we didn't do the best of jobs with our control system there as we kind of ran up a little bit on this concrete barrier, but kept going. That car made it about 1.3 miles before it crashed through a set of barbed wire and then went off-road driving and then got tangled in the barbed wire coming back in. Okay, so that's an example of not such a great control system job. At least we didn't sense barbed wire and compute what to do with barbed wire and actuate away from the barbed wire, unfortunately. Okay, so so this idea then of control is that it's sensing, computation, and actuation in a feedback loop, and we will see all of these pieces come up and what role they play. All right, so whether it's a feedback system that occurs in nature or a control system that we've designed, there are really two main principles that are going to go throughout this course. And those two principles are that we can get robustness to uncertainty through feedback, and that we can design the dynamics of a system through feedback. So what do I mean by these two things? So robustness to uncertainty, it's kind of an amazing thing if you think about it, that you can take a system with unreliable components and create a system with very precise behavior. A good example of that comes from the world of electrical engineering. So here's a little amplifier circuit, and if you take out your iPod and you dial it up to some level of volume, and you take out your friend's iPod and you dial up some level of volume, and take somebody else's iPod and you dial it up, and you listen to them, they're all going to sound about exactly the same volume, right? Very precisely. But if you go inside that iPod and look at what's happening, you're going to find that there are these transistors in here, and these transistors have a gain to them that goes along with their amplification, and that gain might vary a factor of 10 between those three iPods. And so we've got the components of my system might vary by a factor of 10 in their gain, and yet somehow my system is extremely repeatable. And the way that you do that is that you use feedback. And in particular, if you have a way to accurately sense the output volume, then I can tell whether the output volume is what I want, and I can use that to cut down on the gain into my system to regulate it at the proper level. And so this idea of accurate sensing allowing us to compensate for highly uncertain components is a key idea in feedback. And so we can use feedback to get robustness to uncertainty, here uncertainty in the parameters of a system, but more generally other types of things. We can also talk about using feedback to design the dynamics of a system. And so here's an example of that. This is an X-29. It's an experimental aircraft. It has forward swept wings. And so if you think about forward swept wings for a little bit, just think about when you kind of stick your arm out of the car window, right? If you point it forward and you tilt it up a little bit, right, the wind grabs it and really pulls it up quickly. And so you can imagine that you can get very large control forces with these forward swept wings by just tilting them in the right way up. But you can also imagine that this is a pretty unstable system, right? Because what stops that process? Nothing on its own, right? I mean, if you take your arm, you eventually, right, either let it go all the way back or you pull it back down. But if you take this aircraft and you don't do anything, as soon as it tilts up a little bit, it's going to just flop over, right? Wings are going to break apart. All sorts of bad stuff's going to happen. That's not the desired dynamics of the system, right? The desired dynamics of the system are that it can fly forward, right, and maintain level flight, and I can turn and do all of these things. And we accomplish that through feedback. In particular, we sense the angle of the aircraft. We use that sensed angle to manipulate through a control law certain actuators. And here these actuators might be, for example, these canard-like things up in the front that can be used to modulate the flow. And in fact, the dynamics of the system are much too fast for a human to be able to do that. So you can imagine a human says, oh, I'm tilting up, I'm going to move the stick down, you know, oh, I'm starting to tilt down, right? The dynamics of this system are so fast that we have to use an electronic system to do that. And so it's a good example of when you're designing this aircraft, you're going to design it so that the open loop system, that is without closing that feedback loop, is unstable, but the closed loop system flies very nicely, just like the high performance plane that it's supposed to be. And if we have time at the end, I'll tell you a story about this particular aircraft, because what they didn't do when they designed this aircraft is apply some of the principles that we're learning in this class that tell you what the limits on achievable performance are. So how good can you make the system? You can't make it behave like any arbitrary aircraft. There are limits to how good you can get this system to be, and we'll talk some about those. But here the idea is that we can have the natural response or the open loop response of a system, and when we close the loop around it, we can modify that response. And again, in an engineering setting, we can think about designing the dynamics of the system. So here's an example of both of those principles. And so I'm going to come back to this cruise control system. And so I've got Bob, my system. So that's Bob. And I have a disturbance, which might be going up a hill or coming into wind. I have a reference, which is the speed that I'd like to be going, 55, 65 miles an hour, whatever it is. And I've got my control law. And so here in this system, I've sort of built in the actuators and the system dynamics and the sensors, and so I'm just sort of representing that as a single block that comes back around and gives me the speed. I compare the speed to the reference speed, and then I put a control law in there. And so if we want to analyze this system, and this is what we're going to be doing through the term, and then we say, all right, well, what are the dynamics of this system? How does this system evolve in time as a function of the inputs and other things? And so here is a differential equation, and we'll talk about ODEs as a modeling tool with inputs and outputs next week, but this is a simple differential equation. V dot is the rate of change of V with respect to time, so dV by dt, so it's the acceleration. And this is just F equals ma, right? So here's the mass times the rate of change of velocity, that's acceleration, so that's the ma part. And then the forces that apply to the vehicle are drag forces due to wind and wheels and other things. And here I've modeled those as a linear dependence on the velocity V. So B is some constant that depends on the vehicle that tells me how much drag do I get. So a big boat-like vehicle gets a lot less than a smooth aerodynamic vehicle. I also have the forces that are being applied by the engine and the forces that are being applied, let's say, if I'm going up a hill, by the hill, so gravity. And so I can take this set of dynamics as my system and I can write a control law. And so we'll write a very simple control law. We'll say that the engine force should be equal to some constant k times the difference between my desired velocity and the actual velocity of my system. So I'm going to sense the velocity of my system, v. I'm going to compare that to the desired velocity. That's my reference in this picture. And then I'm going to apply a force on the engine that's proportional to the difference between these two. So if I have a large error, I'm going to apply more force. If that error, and we got to choose the signs of this, right? But if I'm going too slow, I'm obviously going to apply a force that increases the speed of the engine. So if v is smaller than v desired, k should be a positive number so that I apply positive force to the vehicle, and that will cause me to speed up. So if we look at this system, we can do some simple computations on this system to see how it reacts as a control system. And so the first thing that we can do is that we can check to see whether this system is stable. And we're going to talk about how to do that, but for now, let me just do that sort of graphically. If I look at starting at some velocity, suppose this is 50 miles an hour, and having some desired velocity, suppose this is 60 miles an hour, and I plot the response of this system, here's what the response of that system might look like. And we see that we go to a constant value here, and so it's a stable system. We maintain a constant operating point. It's a smooth response. It doesn't go too fast and then slow down or do anything else. It's a nice looking response. And it's stable in the sense that it holds this value. We can also look at what this value is, that is, how fast do I go? And if you actually take this system and solve for it, and we'll talk exactly about how to do this next week and the week after, then you can show that the steady state, so SS stands for steady state, the steady state velocity is given by this expression here. Right. So it's k, where k was our control gain, over b plus k. B was this coefficient of friction, times the desired velocity, plus 1 over bk times, sorry, this should be f hill, not u hill. So that expression allows us to look at some of the robustness properties of this system. And in particular, let's notice, well, so let's do a couple of things. Let's notice that if k is pretty large, then what is this going to look like? Well, this term here, 1 over b plus k, if k is much bigger than b, then this k is 1 over k. And if k is pretty big, that says that the effect of the hill is small. And so if I hit a hill and I've got a large gain k from my controller, then this term is not going to affect my steady state speed very much. So we want a large k, a large gain for our controller. Furthermore, if I have a large gain on the controller, then k over b plus k, right? If k is much bigger than b, then this looks approximately like k. This is k over something that's almost k. That's about 1. And so we see that the steady state velocity is, in fact, equal to roughly the desired velocity plus some small perturbation. So, and the bigger k is, the better the performance of the system is, right? Because larger k's will give us things that are closer to 1 here and closer to 0 here. And in particular, as k approaches infinity, this coefficient approaches 1, this coefficient approaches 0. We can also see some of the robustness properties at this point, because we can notice that it really doesn't matter what b is if k is big enough. Suppose that k is a million. Suppose that b is 10. All right. Suppose now that instead of b being equal to 10, b is equal to 1,000. Right? What's a million over a million plus 10? Right? About 1. What's a million over a million plus 1,000? About 1. Right? So I had a factor of 100 change in the viscous damping. Right? I mean, all of a sudden I opened all the doors, like, you know, put a big tent on the top, all of these things. And from the point of view of, right, this term, it really didn't matter very much. And this term either, right? What's 1 over a million plus 10 or 1 over a million plus 1,000 doesn't really matter. So that's an early indicator. Notice also that the mass of the vehicle doesn't actually enter into this. It doesn't matter how heavy the vehicle is from the steady state speed. For performance, it will. How quickly you can accelerate obviously can depend on how heavy your car is, how powerful your engine is. All right, so there's an example of a control system, and we see some of these ideas of uncertainty and the use of feedback to mitigate that uncertainty. And the design of dynamics is, what do you want this curve to look like? Here's another example. This is one in nature. This is just an awesome video. This came out of Michael Dickinson's lab here at Caltech. So what you were seeing was a fly that got startled as it was coming out of this tube, and so it jumped. And as it jumped, right, it had to start remembering that, oh, I'm a fly, I need to fly. And so it had to start flapping its wings, and it caught itself. And look at this behavior, right? Look how stable that is, right? It's just flying straight up, hovering, right? All of those things. I mean, it's really an amazing example of the fly's ability to maintain, right, a desired operating point. So what does it use to do that? Well, it has sensors. It has its eyes. It can see things moving around. It has something called halteres, which are little gyroscopes. They're vestigial wings that beat on the fly. Those are the sensors for this system. It has actuators. It has these big, powerful wings that allow it to move. But it also has specialized muscles that allow it to modulate that wing beat, and by modulating that wing beat, to stabilize itself. So it's an example of a control system in nature. In this particular case, in a fly, we've got sensing, we've got actuation. What about the computation? Well, that's in the brain. Right? So the brain of the fly, depending on the species of fly, maybe 200,000 to 500,000 neurons, does that control law computation. It takes all of the input from the eyes and the halteres and everything else and decides how do I move the wings. And it's really an amazing example of a control system. Okay, so there's some examples of control systems now. And again, this idea that the fly, through evolution, has tuned its dynamics to be very good at things like avoiding fly swatters and finding food and other things. It's robust, so if you, probably as a child, you may have, used a magnifying glass and burned flies. If you aren't quite that cruel, but you just clip the wings of a fly or do something else, they can still fly, right? So if any of you are pilots, I encourage you to try this on your aircraft, right, which is to take off the last third of the wing and see what happens, okay? And so I would say flies are a little bit more robust than aircraft, at least in that particular setting. Okay, so one of the cool things about control is that there's a lot of theory there, and the theory allows us to understand these systems, and we're going to go look at these as example systems. In fact, in your homework, you're going to learn a little bit about the visual system of a fly. But it has developed a set of approaches to looking at these types of feedback problems. And those approaches are approaches in modeling and looking at how we have input-output representations of systems so that we can interconnect them. System identification, how do we identify the dynamics of an existing system, as well as techniques for creating models and reducing models. So it's easy to get a model that's extremely complicated for something, but getting a model that's simpler that captures the key dynamics is trickier. And over the decades now, control has developed those modeling tools. There are also analysis tools. Given a feedback system, how do we analyze whether the system is stable? How do we check for robustness? And we'll talk about robustness margins. And how do we look at performance of those systems? And so we'll talk about all of these things. And then finally, synthesis. In an engineering context, we can actually design control systems. And so there are tools for constructively designing the controller part of a feedback system. So I give you a system, I want to design a controller to give a certain amount of robustness or to give a certain amount of performance. And I can do that, and to give stability and all of that. And there are, for all of these things that have been developed, an extensive set of toolboxes that are available. Here I've listed just the MATLAB toolboxes, but there are similar toolboxes in Mathematica and other LabVIEW and other programs. And so we will use some of these. We'll use Simulink. We'll use the Control System Toolbox. We'll use those two a lot. Some of you will use some of the tools down here in later studies and other things. The Robust Control Toolbox, the System ID Toolbox, Systems Biology Toolbox, various other tools that exist. And so more or less for lots of the things that you can find in the literature on here's how to do this type of analysis or synthesis, you can find a toolbox in MATLAB that does that. And so we will use a lot of those tools so that you see how they work. Okay, so that's kind of what we're going to talk about in the class at a high level, is we're going to go in and we're going to look at these feedback systems, we're going to look at control systems, and we're going to understand how to analyze them initially and then design them as we go through. And we'll do design examples at the beginning that we'll see in a little bit ad hoc, pick gains, guess, things like that, but we're going to make those more and more systematic as we go through the term. All right, so in particular, the way that we're going to do this is that this week I'll talk about just introducing concepts, and so on Wednesday, for those of you in CDS 110, I will go through and talk a little bit more about control systems and how we implement control systems and what that looks like in a little bit more detail than I've done here. On Friday, Luis will give a tutorial on MATLAB. Let me say that if you've never used MATLAB before, it's an absolutely critical tool for this class. You want to get good at it, come to the tutorial. And I would say everybody should go and start installing MATLAB on your computers. If I remember right, the Caltech license allows you to install it on your personal computer. Check that. If that's not true, you can certainly use it on Caltech computers, and there are plenty of them in the various labs around. We'll have a Simulink tutorial, another part of MATLAB, next week as we start to talk about system modeling, and then we'll go through and basically study the various things that we talked about. So we'll talk about what does stability and performance look like. We'll then specialize to linear systems and talk about how to design feedback controllers for linear systems. We'll then move into what's called the frequency domain and talk about transfer functions and how to analyze in the frequency domain. And so we'll talk about loop analysis, PID control. So 95% of all control systems use PID, and the ideas of PID, in particular the use of anticipation and the use of integral feedback are key in all sorts of systems, so it's a great example. And then we'll talk some about how to design things and analyze robust performance. Okay, So that's what I wanted to tell you today, which is really just kind of an introduction. So what I hope you came away with was the notion that a feedback system is one that involves interconnection between different parts of systems, and we're going to dive into what that means. A control system has sensing, computation, and actuation connected together in a feedback loop, and the key principles are this idea of robustness to uncertainty and design of dynamics. Are there any questions? Remember your mud cards. What part didn't you understand? Write it down on the mud card so that I know what we need to spend more time on and so we can post an answer for you. Okay, that's it. And mud cards, we'll put a box up in the front and in the back, or just dump them on the overhead projector here in front.
Do you need blank ones? Do you want the blank ones back?
You can leave the blank ones on the table and we'll pick them up.
Do you have any more course surveys and surveys?